Hello, my name is Mike Diedrich, and I'm a member of Veterans for Peace, Daniel Ellsberg, Chapter 92 in Seattle. And this is the VFP radio show, which is broadcast on KODX 96.9 FM. It's also archived there, past recordings, and also at the VFP92.org website. So today, I'm going to give a short introduction to myself, which I haven't done before, really, and also host Michael Sims, who's our current secretary and also an Iraq veteran. And this might be a little bit of jumpy because of the original recording got cut off during a power outage yesterday. So this is sort of a recording that will splice onto the one that we recorded yesterday. So I'm a Vietnam veteran. I was drafted and eventually sent to Vietnam and served as an interrogator linguist in 1960. I was drafted in 66. I served until almost 1968, 32 months all told. I was there for the Tet Offensive and the May Offensive, and it was the events of the May Offensive in particular that led me to really question what we were doing in Vietnam, because the saw the way that the United States fought the war, and the way the United States fought the war usually involved a lot of firepower and often directed at civilians. In my case, this was a village next door to us. During the May 7th, they came through there, and they thought that they saw some VC in there, and ended up blowing the entire village away with 250-pound and 500-pound bombs, white phosphorus, napalm, gunships. We knew some of these people, and it was very traumatic, certainly for them, but also for us to see people we knew being killed in this sort of a cavalier and savage manner. After the war, I came back to Seattle and got involved fairly soon after, particularly after the invasion of Cambodia. I said that was sort of the last straw for me, and got involved with Vietnam Veterans Against the War, eventually serving as a regional coordinator and a chapter head also for the Vietnam Veterans Against the War chapter in Seattle. And we did a lot of anti-war work with other organizations. One thing that was noted is that the anti-war veterans had a lot of respect, got a lot of respect from the other anti-war organizations. We had a lot of authority, and that was often the case. They were always glad to see you, and there weren't a lot of veterans protesting the war, but there were quite a few under the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. And then, of course, later with the Veterans for Peace, of which I've been a member of for the past 20 years, serving as a president and vice president. My guest, Michael Sims, is an Iraq veteran. Was in the National Guard and ended up going to Iraq as an engineer. And I'm going to let him to. He can't talk right now because it was recorded earlier, so I'm sort of filling in for him. But he was an Iraq veteran, an engineer, and ran convoys and that sort of thing. And his experience with the war led him to be, question what he was doing there. And also, after he got out, and dealing with his own PTSD and other medical issues, eventually joined Veterans for Peace. So let's, I don't know, pick up where we left off, where you.
I've been talking about when I saw the event you did at UW back in 2022.
Oh,
I think it was like October.
the talking about my book with the Christoph Gebel.
Oh, sorry, you VFP, the Daniel Ellsberg chapter,
Oh, that
the
one. Yeah.
and yeah, I mean, it's, I had sort of been doing some, been with groups that sort of did online stuff and reading or whatever, but it was like the sort of work that VFP did was, it was like a light bulb for me, of just any, yeah, like how there, a bunch of different stuff I was sort of, yeah, enthralled by from that event that y'all were talking about. But anyways, I got involved from that, and it's yeah, I'm happy, and but I am sad that I did not do it earlier. And I feel, a little bit that it took so long for me to sort of get out, start to process all the stuff and my military service and try and sort of figure out how to fit it into my world, and that it sort of gave me the feeling of like having a way to translate this experience into something positive.
Yeah, well, for a lot of veterans across the, generations, really, a lot of them, well, say going back to say World War II veterans, for example, they were not encouraged to talk about their war at all, even though they, a lot of them had serious PTSD and alcohol, what have you. And for, say, fast forward through, I don't know, to Korea. Probably the same thing in Vietnam, and for myself, I was sort of, I mean, the sort of thing, well, what was it like over there? I mean, you probably heard that sort of thing. What was it like going to Iraq or well, it was a fucking mess is what it was, and in polite conversation, and not necessarily with my family. I've stopped more than one of our dinner parties and getting and says, "Well, I don't want to hear anything about that, for being a member of VFP, it was an outlet to do that, actually, because it was, I mean. If you're talking at a dinner party, picking up dead bodies or looking at bloated bodies that's not polite conversation, but that's what, so you want to know what it's like? Well, that's what it's like.
And I just it yeah it's something I just never knew what to do with, whatever. People would, especially back when I was young, people would always ask questions I didn't want to answer, at a party or something like that.
Right,
But then
yes.
for people I'm close to, yeah, it's that thing of like, if you sort of want to know what it was like, I don't want you to know what it was like.
Yeah.
It was awful, and
Well,
it's like you think about.
one of the things when I first got back, I hadn't been home for more than a day or so. And my mother, who was a school teacher, really a sharp person, generally speaking, and politically sharp, she knew that I was an interrogator. And she said, so, Michael, are you a war criminal? I said, well, shit. My dad said, well, Eve, don't. And I said, well, I sort of dissembled and I said, thinking about it, yeah, well, although I didn't beat people up or torture, some of the people I know did. And for our allies, and you probably ran across this with the Iraqi military, torture is a default experience with them. So, and then it got a little mature, sort of more mature, realization of what war is, and they are wars that tend to be criminal activities, period. I mean, I don't care what you think they are or how glorious the event is, you end up being, if not an actual thug, helping other thugs fight the war, and so.
And I try to like hold on to that idea of all right, at least the sort of work I was doing, maybe it helped such and such, but like I was still part of this thing. And then we would get these details to, I mean, whatever, help, a bunch of detainees would come in. These are just 9/10 of them, just probably some random person in the wrong, wrong place at the wrong time. Yeah, anyways, I can go on about that stuff forever where yeah, that they would have a contractor do the interrogation, and this was also one of the lessons. So the contractor, I remember the first time I had to like just sort of stand guard while they were asking questions to somebody, and the guy looked at the interpreter instead of the interrogator, and the interpreter or the interrogator smacked him across the face. And it was a contractor. And somebody asked about this later, and he said, "What are they going to do, Article 15 me?" And so it like that sense that the Iraq War was also, I mean, Blackwater and the stories you would hear about them, but that it was also net, being prosecuted by private industry that was sort of outside of UCMJ or like any of the control mechanisms that could rein in any of that stuff. That was one of my big takeaways from that experience, that like the Iraq War was a boom for private and defense contractors and private industry.
I didn't see any sort of contractors, but the Vietnamese and their routine abuse of prisoners. But the UCMJ and the Geneva Convention are very specific. It says as a member of the U.S. military, you're not allowed to let those people do that. And it means you're complicit. If you let somebody beat somebody up or torture them, that's on you. And that's the UCMJ is pretty clear about that sort of thing. And you can't say, well, he was a contractor. No, he was somebody who's operating under the auspices of the United States military, and what they were doing is illegal. As for myself, I was able to walk away from some of that, when people were being tortured, I just walked away from it, and I was lucky to do that. So I didn't have to, have that sort of unsee that sort of thing. But there's no really. I mean, you're complicit in it by law, international, American, and military law.
There had, I mean, there was also this sense that a lot of the violence that was directed at us, meaning US military, was in response to stuff that these contractors were doing. Of yeah, because I mean, I don't know if they were just talking or whatever, but like these guys would like, be in the same mess hall as us. And they try and like, show off, basically bragging about, awful stuff that they were doing as if it made them cool or tough. And, there was no distinction from the Iraqi people between a contractor and military. We were the part of the same thing. And then the other part was like, so I was in this guard unit, and like we didn't have up armored vehicles, and we were having to like weld buy steel from the locals and weld it to our vehicles so we'd have some protection. The military didn't give us this, but they would give us, new Under Armour t-shirts all the time, or new Wile E X glasses all the time, where it was, clear that all this money was being given to all of these companies for everything but the stuff that we needed.
Well, for me, the really serious reappearance of my PTSD happened when I was looking at Fallujah, and that sort of that was a little after your time there, but where they went in there and just had this, this basically took retook that it was, I'm most of some Marine units and Army too, but they just went in there and then had a house to house fighting and just shot the place to pieces. And I saw a lot of that in Vietnam too. I mean, it looked like World War II.
And that was by my understanding too. Like, I mean, I think they treated it as like a free fire zone. Which, yeah, to me seemed, yeah, real straight out of Vietnam. They gave everybody some. So the first battle was in April and was treated as a victory because the Marines and Army units had to pull out. And this also helped sort of bolster the insurgency nationwide. And then I guess the second battle was in November of that year. And yeah, just it's like they give everybody, some notice, you have to leave the city. And it's, these are not all people with the means to do so. And then yeah, and
Well,
it's cruel, and it's hard not to also think of Gaza and sort
yeah.
of these IDF evacuation orders and how meaningless they are, how impossible they are to follow.
Well, I wrote a little piece about that too. I'll send that on to you, but about Vietnam and Gaza. But the idea that these IDF soldiers, they're going to have some problems. I mean, I don't know about all the Israelis, that there's over 50,000 dead in Gaza. Probably some of them were not Hamas, but yeah, Hamas. But those IDF soldiers are watching when the Gazans came back. They're watching these Gazans drag dead bodies out of the rubble. I mean, what are they thinking then, well, this is a, I mean, the whole country is, I mean, they ended up making Israel a nation of war criminals, and the guys that are going to have to do the heavy lifting are the guys that went there because they were ordered to go and drop the bombs and blow up people and shoot people. And like all wars, the ones that are left with the liability of the war are the people who actually have to do the fighting. And for the Israelis,
I mean, there, I don't know if you saw this article a couple months back, and it was talking about PTSD and IDF soldiers that were coming back. And then the person that they interviewed, I mean, that they talked about someone that had committed suicide, if I recall, but then one person that they're interviewing, the thing that they're describing is, that they're bothered by driving over dozens or hundreds of people. And I mean, it's, you try, I mean, the sort of sympathy can only go so far for something like that. If you want, I mean, you wonder like what indoctrination and what sort of what would make some, yeah, make somebody be okay with that. And then if the implication of that is if it's a society that's okay with that, or a military that, we know doesn't punish people for doing whatever war crimes.
Well, the thing is, and it wasn't so much a case of the terminology when I was in Vietnam or shortly thereafter, but now every soldier is a warrior, everybody's a hero, and doesn't make any difference if you were baking bread or shooting people. It's and then clearly, I mean, I don't like the idea of a hero. I'm sure people who actually were deeply involved in combat or something, I would consider themselves hero. Most people wouldn't, I don't think so. And the terminology of being a warrior, what the hell does that mean? That's a warrior, God. I mean, it's laughable if you think about it, but it's so widely used, probably by even some military to think of themselves as warriors, but.
And this, I think sometimes, I am a product sort of like the indoctrination that I got of this sort of 1990s rehabilitation of the military image almost. I mean, and then late 90s, you have movies where even if it was like Saving Private Ryan and they're showing sort of, warts and all of the US military, you also had this, Black Hawk Down or whatever other movies, and me as a dumb teenager, of course I'm watching these action movies. And it's shown that, US military is a force for good. So I join up into that, and it's in this period where no one could criticize the military. No one could, write about it, or and it's like you felt like you were this sort of new class of person in the United States. This military that can't sort of cannot be questioned, and everybody's a hero, and and I sure as hell did not feel like a hero after, after the deployment. And then the more I learned about it, the less and less I felt like one. But that thing that where it's as if all of our good virtues of, courage and willingness for self-sacrifice, that it gets funneled as if that's its highest realization is, join the military and be a hero. And, it's,
Well, did you have, I mean, I had it too, sort of like similar sort of attitudes, although when I went in, there was, I sort of went in knowing that it was a mess. But I mean, the options for somebody in 1966 was, you could go to Canada, you'd go underground, you could go, do something else. But I mean, or go in the military. So there were not a lot of good options. So, I lost my train of thought here, but I mean, in any war, there aren't any real good options. And you sort of learn once you don't learn until you go in. And it's hard to describe to civilians, even who are got a sympathetic ear, about how awful it was. And the language sometimes is almost not enough, but I've tried, and I think you probably have too, to tell this is not what you read about in the books, and this is you take somebody. I use the example of somebody, so a 17-year-old kid who's drinking beer in a parking lot in high school, and 6 8 months or a year later, he's in some strange country shooting people. What happened there? He went into the military, they indoctrinated him. These people are our enemies, and you're going to go kill them. So, and that's not a far-fetched scenario at all. I mean, that's what they do. So I mean, when we do counter-recruiting work in the schools, and you're talking to kids about the military, he says, "Well, they call it the armed forces, and they call them that for a reason." He says, "You're going to put a uniform on and pick up a gun, and if you're actually not shooting people or blowing people up themselves, you're supporting the people who are doing that." So there's no sort of safe ideological place for in the military. And they, of course, they always say, you can't obey a not a legal owner, but or a lawful order. As some 18 year old E4, you're going to say, "What's a lawful order?" And not, he says, "Well, go to that village, and they're just, you're getting some fire. Then you pull up there with their APC or something like that, and train your 50 caliber on it, and just blow everything to pieces." Well, we got some fire from there, so.
So yeah, I mean, then this is the issue that, like, of one, someone low ranked, so they're gonna listen to who's ahead of them. Also, like, me at 20, 21, when I was there, I wasn't 18, 19, but my brain still hadn't formed, and everybody else is like me, at that age, that The heaviness of it. Yeah, I mean, it's you. I remember this feeling that it was like as if you wanted to have trained for every scenario that you would go into because you just didn't know what to do. Like you didn't know exactly what to do if you took fire from such and such, distance or whatever, or what to do if, anyways, these, a car was, you had stopped a convoy and the car was come, so car was coming from a side road, all this sort of million things, and always this feeling of, I just need to know what to do in this situation because there's just too much stress to think about anything at a meta level or anything like that. And so sort of youth and indoctrination and command structure and if there's
Well,
loose rules of
after,
engagement and self-preservation, it's a horrible combination.
even after, we saw that village blown away, and we had our villagers who we knew came to our compound and try to help get help. We didn't have any help. Our medic didn't even have any morphine. So, but I was thinking about some of these pilots who are dropping napalm, and will fight phosphorus. White, they're ugly, awful, grotesque things to drop on people. And I said, well, eventually I said, if I had been in that situation as a pilot or something like that, and door gunners or something like that, I might have done the same thing, I can't. It wasn't easy. I couldn't point any fingers at these guys, who are pilots
I
blowing
mean,
these people up.
we in the military, you meet the sort of person that you get the sense sometimes that, you meet these people that they just want a justified reason to like be in combat and shoot people. Whatever. This is not, there may be some motivation, but no, it's like that realization that like that these are people that are a product of training and indoctrination. And the complexity of the system to sort of put someone, like the door gunner that's willing to sort of open fire, what is it that leads to that being okay? They wouldn't do it to a town in their home state, so what is it that has made this different?
Well, for some of it, when I was in the Army too in the 60s, of course, there were a lot of World War II Korean, some of the senior enlisted there. And one of the things I remember reading, running into this guy who was a Green Beret Sergeant Major or Master Sergeant in a club or something like that. And he was drunk. And I didn't have any markings on my uniform because they didn't like us to sort of broadcast that we were, spooks or what have you. And he says, "What are you doing?" And I says, and he was drunk too. And he said, "So what do you do?" And I says, "Well, I work in military intelligence. I'm an interrogator." And he says, "Oh shit, I just killed him." Here's a guy he was in Korea and Vietnam. I guess he was jumped in Normandy. So he's like an old timer, an old fucking criminal soldier. And for somebody who just knew in the country, I said, "Well, Jesus Christ." Well, and I found out that wasn't far from the truth from what I learned for after 11 months later,
Yeah, I think I mean, the approach that some people ended up feeling in Iraq, whether they acted on it or not. I mean, I remember even like feeling like this sometimes, just like human life just becomes so sort of meaningless after you're just around all this violence or whatever. And that like, people talk, I've sort of thought like this in moments or talk to people where it's just like, I'd rather shoot somebody than sort of deal with the problem or a question or whatever. Like not a question from them, but sort of in the state in any ambiguity. And didn't act on it, or the guys in my unit didn't act on it, but that others did. And that's also just, yeah, this, I mean, dehumanization, that's part of the whole process too. That a little bit of interaction can sort of remedy of recognizing that these are just people
Yeah. And
saying.
in that respect, I was lucky from many soldiers in most wars that I spoke some Vietnamese, so I could actually, including my interpreters in Vietnam that I worked with, and in the villages too, that I could get speak enough Vietnamese so that I could interact with them and also, treat them as friends, really. And actually, in the end, to see some of them killed the way they were was deeply saddening and made me very angry. But on the other hand, I didn't think of them as enemy necessarily, including the prisoners that I talked to. I says they were just soldiers like I was, that's not necessarily the case for a lot of soldiers who didn't like them and didn't
Yeah,
they were
that, yeah.
frightened and they didn't like them and they just didn't shoot them as talk to them, look at them. So
I mean, a little, so I don't know. Yeah, you could feel like the odd man out if you had some sort of empathy. I remember an example of this was I mean, this is said when. Anyways, there were a lot of detainees would come on base, and if you weren't like sort of on rotation to do a mission or whatever, so like what would happen is we would go have to help sort out when detainees showed up and stuff. It was that, that and guard duty are the sort of things you would rotate on your off day. And there were some guy, it was always the I it always seemed like the guys that sort of got picked on in the unit would just take their anger out on detainees and cause sort of rifts in the my platoon, to where anyways they ended up sort of real kind of I think realizing that this was causing issues in my unit, and we stopped doing it, and then Abu Ghraib happened and they stopped sort of treating detainees that way. I mean, it wasn't that sort of stuff, but it was like people could, make them run around holding sandbags above their head and stuff like that. And it was cruel. And it was not for any purpose. These are not tr interrogators. These are not trained people. While the guy who was trained would just sort of stand there and look at it, the guy in charge of it. And so then some of us, they just, would have us sort of stand off to the side away from it and just sort of talk to some, hang out with some of the detainees that they had decided weren't worrisome, and they just had to wait a few days to get processed out. But where that, that thing of some people that help that dealing with a helpless person, when they have that sort of control and no empathy, and they just can take stuff out on them. Yeah, sorry. It's just this sort
But
of like
it,
d horrible difference in reactions to situations
and of course,
you see.
you as a junior NCO or a Spec 4 or something like that,
Yeah, I was a PV2.
if you were to go to your platoon sergeant or your CO and says, that's not legal. That's against the UCMJ. You for one thing, you wouldn't think of doing that because you'd be scared of saying something, I mean, the situation about doing something like that just wouldn't come up. It says you wouldn't, even though I mean, we all had a little training in UCMJ and the Geneva Convention. You know that this shit isn't right, but to say something like and put yourself out and put yourself in a vulnerable position is not something you do. And there's sort of the peer pressure too, even
And
though
they're,
these people.
yeah, or yeah, like in my unit, I mean, it was like a National Guard unit in like a country county, and there was a couple of guys, these like real stone cold redneck types that were, NCOs, squad leaders, team leaders, or whatever. And like these guys were bullies, and if you got out of line, they would make your life hell. And out of line for them meant could mean you criticize them. And so then, yeah, if you're a lower enlisted, you feel like second guess, you said second guess your any of that stuff. So yeah, it's but that detainee business, at the time it was just like it was just fucked up. And that was like the start of it, before the violence of my deployment started, of ambushes and firefights and stuff.
And
But
that doesn't improve your attitude towards the Iraqis at all
no,
if they're
and
shooting
because
at
yeah,
you.
you do like there were, yeah, you do start to see everybody as a
Sort of
as some degree suspect. But I learned
fuck them
after the
all.
fact,
Fuck them all.
But I learned after the fact that when the 101st was there, so this was just, I guess, a couple months before I got there, a soldier killed themselves at that base in Tal Afar because of what was happening to the detainees there.
Well,
And so, like, with the shit that they were doing when we got there, must have been the, tamped down version or whatever. It just, it seemed like they would rotate units in there to let them blow off steam, just scream at people for no reason.
Well,
But
for not necessarily having to deal with actually the psychological, physical thing of actually shooting people or getting wounded or something like that. I mean, the VA now acknowledges there's such a thing as moral injury, that meaning that you could just be part of this machine. You don't necessarily have to be actively shooting or that sort of active participation. But knowing that you're part of this thing is distressing and a legitimate, according to the VA, part of a PTSD.
I wondered if they would, like, the implications of if they were to give, if it became like a DSM-5 diagnosis, or it became like a compensatable thing or something, and this acknowledgement that, like, yeah, maybe if we're realizing moral injury is a thing, what does that tell us about like how unnatural this is, or how awful this stuff is that we're doing, that it being a part of it can wreck somebody's psyche for the rest of their lives?
Well, as far as I understand it, DSM does recognize moral injury as being part of a PTSD.
Okay.
I'm not. I mean, it is something that is part of the VA.
Yeah, and the treatment regimen. Yeah, I mean, I know this from personal experience. It's part of the stuff I deal with. But yeah, it's like, I imagine it, like, if it became something that the VA would compensate. Which, of course, like, then it's this strange thought of like, someone goes over, you end up killing somebody, and then you feel bad about it, and then you're compensated for it. Which, because of the psychological impact that it has, like, sure, it wrecks people. But then it also makes you think about, like, what what about the Iraqis? What about the, they have to live in this world, they have to live in the world we created for them. Do we support them? Of, and that it is this acknowledgement of this sort of giant amount of violence that was produced because of the Iraq occupation.
Well, it's kind of it's very forward thinking or forward acting as part of the VA, and also and like you just mentioned, it's kind of revolutionary in the sense that if you participate in this sort of thing, it doesn't make any difference if you think that you're being a hero or you think it's a great war or justified or not. Just being because you're in a war, you're going to have some moral injury. And doesn't make any difference at all how what your political outlook is if
Well,
you think you are a hero.
did you ever, do you, I don't know if you stayed in touch with them, or you knew people not even from your unit that, like, they get, there's this, like, now I think of it as this, like, bro vet thing, where it's like this very conservative, veteran sort of self-identification, and it almost, it's, seems at times that it's sort of embedding yourself in an identity that is beyond being questioned, or like even self-reflection of of things. And that can have, like I imagine, some, I could go live somewhere in Virginia and like, in some towns no one would, think bad of me or whatever for, being in the Iraq War, and I could just
Thank you
sort
for
of
your service.
and just sort of put myself in that mindset of like, whatever, it doesn't matter, and I did this thing and I'm a big hero guy or whatever. And I think for a lot of people it's too much to come to terms with it. I mean, it was too much for me to come to terms with
Yeah.
correctly for a long time, and I tried to do it a bunch of selfish ways that didn't work, of just, drink it away or
Oh
whatever.
yeah, I wasn't really sober for about 6 years afterwards. I mean, I quit drinking. I have been, I don't drink anymore, but that self-medication was and I talk when I'm talking to the VA, some of the counselors, they say, "Oh yeah, you were just medicating yourself," you know. They said, "Sure."
And the VAs for this stuff is leaps and bounds beyond what it was like when you got back. And even, in 2005, I mean, the first time I went to get mental health treatment was 6 months after my deployment. That's about how long it I was dr felt I was pretty much drunk the entire time in this 6 months, and then just sort of snapped. Anyways, just took a long time for any of the sort of good advice to stick, but there was already a new PTSD treatment pro, center sort of being developed, and I had a really good doctor, and there was, some acceptance in the military, a very small amount of, talking about it, about PTSD or like, having nightmares all the time or whatever. And I feel like that was not the case even, when you were in or getting out, getting back from deployment.
Well, it wasn't what happened with the VA was that it was Vietnam veterans. No, and particularly Vietnam veterans of America, Vietnam veterans against the war, who went into the VA and says, "We're going to change this shit." And they got into the VA, into the programs, and got PTSD treatment facilities and vet centers and that sort of thing. And it was my generation of veterans taken over from the World War II generations of veterans who made the VA better than it was. But they weren't going to do it. I mean, World War II generation of veterans regarded Vietnam veterans in particular as baby killers, as if they fucking didn't kill babies in World War II, and that we lost the war, as if, Christ. And the other thing is, and when I make criticism of, I've had World War II veterans tell me, "You're not a real veteran. You wouldn't really criticize the government that way if you were a real veteran, you know?" And what happened with the VFW and the American Legion, to the old line veterans organization, after Vietnam, their membership crashed because no Vietnam veteran was going to go in there and listen to these old fucks bullshit about, belittle you because you were a fucking Vietnam veteran. And fuck you.
Well, and my brief experience sort of checking them out after I got back was it was Vietnam veterans belittling you for
Well, the Vietnam Veterans of America, which I belong to, is a pretty good organization. They've got a model that says, "Never again will one generation of veterans forget another." And that's what happened with World War II, in particular towards Vietnam veterans. And it's sad if Vietnam veterans are telling Iraq or Afghanistan veterans that, "You didn't have a real war. I did. You know, I've got bigger balls than you do." And
I know.
I've had actually Iraq and Afghanistan veterans tell me, "Oh, you had it really rough. I didn't have it." So you're kidding me. At any given point and thing or experience in Iraq or Afghanistan, it could be just as horrible as any experience in Vietnam.
Yeah, I mean, this is something to, where it's like, yeah, you always feel self, or I always would feel sort of self-conscious, like, do I, am I entitled to feel like this? You know, like, you know, there's a, you know, couple battles I was in that were in, you know, Wikipedia. So does that, you know, that sort of rated that. So does that count? You know, but no, it's like there's always going to be the guy, you know, that had a worse experience. You know, the army, you're always comparing the level of suck in the army, and there's always somebody with worse. And so, like, that's a rabbit hole. It's
I stayed away from the VA because I hated the army, to be quite honest with you. And I stayed away from the VA because I associated them with the army. And I was talking to an old high school classmate of mine, Elmo LeBeau, may he rest in peace. He was a Marine Corps Vietnam veteran. And his job, his last 6, 8 months in the military, was taking, he was an Indian, Klamath Indian, I think it was. His job was to take dead Indians back to the reservation. So he took, accompanied these caskets back, you know, dead person, dead Indian after dead Indian. And he told me, and I said, I was having some doubts about this issue. He said, look, Mike, he says, you put on a uniform, you're in the military, you're entitled to everything that they can get you. And that is, go to the VA and get some help, which I did. And but that's what I tell, you know, people who says, well, I didn't really do that. But anybody who's in the military, it's just a crapshoot or a flip of a coin what you end up doing. I mean, they had guys from the Air Force driving convoy in Iraq and you know,
Yeah.
they were Air Force mechanics.
Yeah, those guys. And then, like, in the army, 88 Mike saw some of the most combat truck drivers because that's where the combat happened, out on the roads. And so, yeah, you don't know it. It's just, yeah, one person's in one position. Say my, you know, tying to people, other guard units, other guard engineer units, and like some of them were in worse stuff than I was. Some of them just were just, you know, on guard duty on towers, you know, the whole time. But it's all, you know, it's all shit. It's all you lose a year of your life. You're in this awful environment. You're surrounded by, you know, misery and violence. It's part of this big, awful thing that's happening. Yeah. And I always got the feeling that too, it was like by design. We were always sort of told, like, oh, the VA, they're never going to give you a compensation. Oh, there's no point. You shouldn't even go there. It's awful. As if they were telling us that, like, the machine, the superstructure or something, was telling us this to keep us from going. And it was not the case when I ended up going. It was like, yeah, these are people that are invested in helping. And you know, when I filed a claim years later, yeah, I had help. And you know, buddies of mine, it took them a really long time because they just thought they weren't entitled, because they think about, you know, oh, I still got my left, you know, or oh, I, you know, I'm not, you know, whatever, you know, whatever. Like, they think that they have some semblance of a normal life, but
I
like,
haven't
you know.
committed suicide yet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, you know,
Yeah.
as on that optimistic note, I'm going to have to probably shut this off. So I'll just conclude it by saying, you know, this is a Veterans for Peace radio show broadcast on KODX 96.9 FM. And thanks again to Michael Sims for being on and sharing his thoughts on life in the military and Iraq. So thanks, Mike. I'm going to
Yeah.
close this up.